On episode 203 of the Happy Market Research Podcast, I'm chatting with Marian Anderson, Research Director at Microsoft. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Attest. Attest is a powerful, easy-to-use SaaS platform that connects businesses to over 100 million consumers in 80 countries on demand in just a few clicks. Ask your burning questions, select who you want to answer, view actionable insights that help you grow your business. Join the hundreds of leading brands who already utilize the power of Attest's scalable intelligence platform. Contact Attest today at www.askattest.com/happymr. That's askattest.com/happymr. Or find the link in the episode's show notes. Hi, I'm Jamie Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. My guest today is Marian Anderson, Director of Research at Microsoft. The Microsoft Corporation is a multinational technology company that creates computer software, consumer electronics, personal computers, and related services. Prior to joining Microsoft in 2013, Marian held senior research positions at Harris Interactive, PSB Research, and GfK. Marian, thanks so much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast with me today.
Thanks, Jamin. Happy to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about your backstory. So you graduated from University of Utah with a degree in political science. How in the world did you wind up in market research?
Well, does anyone end up in research by...
I don't think so. I mean, literally, I've had one person say that they were interested in research post or pre-graduation, and that only happened, and this is literally after 47 interviews, and that happened only months before their graduation.
I don't know that I know a single person, but so that's super, it's that I find interesting in and of itself. So for me, I was, politics was it for me. I was very, very interested in kind of what motivated political behavior and political strategy. And so I had the opportunity right out of undergrad to go work for Mark Penn and work on political messaging, doing political polling. And honestly, I was interested in working in politics kind of in any strategy regard, and it happened to be polling that the opportunity presented itself, and that started my research career, and I kind of haven't looked back. I was only involved in the political side for a couple of years before it became really clear to me that at least working with Mark Penn as a very young researcher, I got zero access to clients and kind of high level strategy on the political side, but he would let me loose on the corporate strategy side. There was, it was kind of, you know, go figure it out, go advise, go, you know, get involved with some on the corporate, go see what you can build. And so I moved over to the corporate strategy side of research within my first couple of years, and then consulted for many, many years at Harris Interactive, really focused on brand strategy and positioning research, which is kind of my first love in research. And it really is the same in political research. That may be why I love it so much, is that, you know, building a brand is building a brand, whether or not you're talking about a political candidate or any given product out there. And then I moved to, so I was with Harris Interactive for a number of years. And then I moved, I had the opportunity to build the Microsoft business on behalf of GfK. And I moved to Seattle at that point to build up that business, did that, and then moved over to Microsoft 5 years ago.
And it's interesting, too, that I believe Mark Penn wound up as an executive at Microsoft at one point in his career.
He did, so not long ago. So I joined Microsoft in 2013. In 2014 or so, Mark Penn came to be co-CMO of Microsoft. And he did that for maybe 18 months. Him and Tammy Reller had this kind of co-CMO job, which was I found it very strange then and still do that we had this co-CMO thing happening. And it was very strange to have Mark Penn back in my world. And then he then moved on to become our chief strategy officer. He did that for maybe a year. I'm probably not getting my timelines quite right. And then he moved on. So yeah, it was coming full circle in a way for me, from starting my career to being pretty well established in my career and having Mark back.
As the month of January for us is rolling out in 2019, the topic is customer experience, which is a center point in the Microsoft Corporation. My tenure with this brand, your brand, by the way, is very long, and it was literally back in the DOS days. And I still remember the very first version of Windows, and I can literally recall where I was sitting when I installed it, right? Anyway, so you guys have, Microsoft has built a strong brand on customer experience. How is Microsoft using data specifically to help drive and deliver on that experience?
Oh, you know, it's been such an amazing evolution. Even in the 5 years that I've been here, the way that we have integrated data in ways that I don't know that we'd ever really done before. You know, Microsoft, for a very long time, by having smart people and building really good products, and then simply our size and scale kind of allowed momentum to go from there. You know, of course, with the very strong vision of having a computer on every desk. And even in the 5 years I've been at Microsoft, the focus on not just customer experience, but really truly empathy for our customers and understanding what is happening for them, and really becoming a company that is interested in operating on behalf of the customer as opposed to kind of simply building something so they can buy it. It's a really interesting cultural shift that Satya, of course, has driven, and it shows up every single day in the data space. So in order to be customer kind of centric, in order to build customer experiences, of course, data comes in at every point. And so we do a lot more. So market research in particular has grown substantially, in the sense that we no longer are looking at one source of data, almost ever. We are all, you know, we are looking at many sources of data, usually to help drive strategy. So that means, of course, traditional kind of qualitative or ethnographic methods. We tend to be very quant heavy here in terms of market research, but now we're bringing things in like internal telemetry, what people are actually doing on their machines, external kind of telemetry that we purchase so that we can understand what's happening with competitors in terms of what what customers are doing. And then we're bringing in things like motivations we see show up in social research, or what's happening with revenue and how that's tied to what people are telling us how they feel about a certain thing. We're much better, for example, about not just measuring satisfaction, kind of overall experience level with a given product, but at a kind of micro experience, what was the satisfaction level with that thing you just did? And so all of that has happened in the last 5 years. And so we really have evolved from an important source of customer data to a aggregator, if you will.
Yeah, it's like multi-sourced, really, isn't it?
It's so hard. And we're learning, and we're, you know, it's hard to do it at the scale and pace that is needed to drive the most important business decisions we have. And that, to be honest, that's been such a privilege to be part of that journey at a company that's so, the amount of data at our fingertips is just unlike anything I've certainly ever been part of before.
Well, the story of Microsoft is super interesting, right? I was actually in high school when Microsoft went public, and it had a really crazy ratio between millionaires and employees. I want to say it was 1 to 5. I'm not positive about that. That's just what I recall. So anyway, the point there being, it really was a product market fit story of there being this massive need and Microsoft being the dominant player to be able to meet it. And then just boom, you know, to your point, you know, let's build stuff that we can then sell. Moving that mentality, you know, if you saw over time, sort of a degradation in the stock price of Microsoft with the new leadership and focus on the customer, empathy, as you said, all of a sudden really pushing that trajectory completely in the opposite direction with fantastic returns for shareholders by putting the customer in the center. That shift I'm really interested in. It's one of the reasons that Reed Hastings has done so well at Netflix, you know, having this customer-minded mentality as opposed to more of the, you know, unwillingness to change. How have you, I know you've only been there for 5 years, but has there been any practical steps that Microsoft has taken in order to install this shift? Or has it been more investment-based, like such as things like research?
It surely is investment-based, but that's more of an outcome in the desire to have a voice in the room that is not the executive team. meaning the customer, right? And there is much more openness to customers having, shall we say, alternative opinions than what the executive team might have thought coming into something. And so there's a lot of discussion that happens where the question is, what is the need? What is the desire? What is the problem we're solving? And frankly, a lot of people being given permission to try things. You know, the Xbox Adaptive Controller is a really good example of this. That was kind of a small crack team of people who really believed that we needed an accessible option for gamers. And they worked for several years trying to drive that product. And they were given the permission and the space to figure that out. And it was absolutely, we're going to go do this. It was a small group of people given the permission to try and to fail and to try again. And it's been an absolute success story for us in terms of making sure we're developing products that you know, allow everyone to play and to game, to be part of the conversation. And so it's, I think really at its core, it's allowing all employees to have a voice that is, I don't think was supported before. And in that, you know, we're gaining so much. And in the employees having a voice, of course, customers come through, and there's a demand for data and a demand for what the understanding of what the customer experience is that's never been present before, certainly not in my experience.
It's interesting how when you're in an executive-based decision versus a customer-based decision, and in the first case on the executive-based, the research, and this is really coming out from my background specifically in the 90s in primary research, you know, you would have your business hypothesis that the research was supposed to, you know, is it true or not true or get to, but at the end of the day, it was really about how can I make that true? I've had more than a few examples in my career where I've had executives say, no, it's really important that the answer is blue, right? Or whatever. And, you know, you wind up crossing some tough ethical lines in that context, as opposed to when you put the consumer in the middle of it. Now, all of a sudden, you need a lot more data in order to triangulate their truth, right? Because just with social media being where it is now, empowered in a large part to with your corporation, you know, you've got a major move from brands used to be who they say they are, and to now they are who their consumer says they are in, oh, and by the way, in real time. So sure as hell better stop paying attention to your rearview mirror and start paying attention to what's happening right in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I do think there are decisions that get made that are based on a belief in the future that is not always based in research. And I think those are still important bets for us to make. And you know, when you're thinking 3 or 5 years out and you're really trying to extrapolate, you know, what customers can't tell you today or can't articulate for you today, those conversations are really important to make sure research informs, but that there's a larger conversation happening with technical teams, with executive teams, et cetera, about those longer term strategic decisions. I think when it comes to the shorter term decisions, that's where the feedback from customers really, you know, it really shines, you know, how we should approach a given feature, how we should approach a set of messaging, pricing decisions, et cetera, you know, even short term portfolio decisions. Those are things, brand strategy decisions, what we're going to do with, for instance, with Skype versus Teams and the Office portfolio, like all those things use data and multiples of data in ways that just would not have happened 5 or 10 years ago.
That's a really important point, which is innovation rarely, I mean, that this is the Ford quote, right? If I ask consumers what they want, it'd just be a better horse. And that's 100% correct. Right, it'd be a better version of DOS, not the transformation of that Windows brought to the marketplace. But to your point, that innovation has to be grounded in where the consumer is, right? And that's one of the things I think we can learn from Steve Jobs when he launched the Newton, which you're probably not old enough to remember, but there was this sort of like pre-iPhone product that entered the market, I want to say around 92, and it was basically the early into the digital assistant space, and it didn't do very well at all. But you know, you see then because the market just simply wasn't ready for it, right? So you need to have that bed of data in order to test and the business hypotheses, which then of course you see in whatever 2006, the iPhone, of course, having tremendous success.
And you you also need to be ready, I think, as a company to go ahead and launch things and try them and have failures in the market. And you know, you see tech companies doing this consistently. The Newton's a good example. You know, we've certainly had examples where we've tried it, then decided it didn't work. And I think that's part of the culture of technology and making sure we're pushing forward. Like, are consumers ready for this, or in our case, commercial audiences, you know, ready for this or not? And just taking the leap and launching something, I think there's real value in that. Test and learn at scale as well.
I like that. So that's a great segue into my next question, which is really centered around voice assistants. So like Amazon's Alexa or Microsoft's Cortana. How do you see that space evolving and impacting customer experience?
You know, I really see voice as just another channel by which people interact with their, whether it be their laptops or their homes or their in their cars. Like, it enables a layer of communication that is really helpful, but it is just that. It is a tool. It is not a tool, in my mind, different than, you know, typing or text or so. For me, it fits into a portfolio of ways we are going to communicate with the world around us. In and of itself, I suppose that's how I feel about it.
I think that's true from the view of a way that we interact with, you know, technology. What's interesting to me is the opportunities that exist inside of these personal assistants. For me, it's the conversation is turning a lot more into Star Wars versus Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where you've got Star Wars, the R2-D2 or C-3PO, you know, thing that is traveling with me, whether that's the mobile phone or desktop or whatever it is, right? That individual versus the Star Trek, where it's this sort of always on voice connection. Adoption seems to be primarily centered around music and audio content versus more of the real power of it, which is business-based time saving. You know what I mean? So like scheduling meetings across two people, just like what we put together in doing this podcast. It does seem to me like there's lots of opportunities for betterment of life and time-saving benefits, but it's, to your point, maybe more in the context of, instead of typing, I'm saying the words, as opposed to it being more of a platform.
I don't view it as a platform. It certainly enables a lot of things, but for instance, the AI behind so much of the voice stuff is no different than what would be required if I asked the same question via text. And so it allows a different, it's a modality. And I do think that there's something about the real-time nature of it that is interesting. Like, I find myself, for instance, I probably use Alexa a little bit differently maybe than some. Like, I will ask her constantly to add things to my to-do list. But like, if I'm at home walking around, it's a helpful way to get things out of my head. And I find myself wanting to interact with her almost constantly. Like, I'm on my way to work. Oh, Alexa. Oh, Alexa's not here right now. You know?
Totally, totally. And that's, believe me, I'm a week away from 48 and I get that creature habit thing. The more than ever, it feels like every year it's a little harder for me to change. I even tried my hand at Snapchat for almost a year and a half and I just have finally given up entirely. I just can't get, it doesn't feel organic to me, I guess is how I put it, right? The one thing that's also interesting, I had my daughter at the time, she was, I want to say 8. She's now 11. So I bought her an iPhone and I was driving, we were on a drive together and I asked her about her best friends. And she said, I have two best friends. I said, oh, that's cool. Who are they? And so one is Hannah and the other is Siri. Now, she's a little bit of a witty child. I thought she was making a joke. But as I was diving deeper in, she literally didn't understand that, you know, when she would call her friend Hannah and then she would call Siri, it was like one was a robot, right? One was an AI-based voice assistant. It was crazy for me kind of processing that as a dad, thinking, holy shit, there's a big potential shift that could happen here. Is this a real human being or not? And then to your point about now the overall opportunity to interact with that thing becomes all the time, right? Doing all sorts of stuff for me across different environments, whether I'm driving to work or whatever.
Right. Yeah, it is. That's fascinating. That's how she thinks of Siri.
Yeah. Well, and she's matured past that now, of course. I mean, it was 100% all in. I didn't have the heart to tell her it wasn't real.
Right.
You know, it took me a couple days to kind of figure out how to have that conversation.
Right. Talk about a conversation you never thought you'd have.
Right. Exactly. As you think about all these different sources of consumer insight, you know, from social to transactional, how do you combine all that? Is the data stream feeding into a dashboard or is it in some proprietary BI?
Oh gosh, I wish there was one easy answer to that.
It's just a lot of different data sources, right?
Many, yes. And so in some cases, we are fortunate enough to have customer data connected to on an individual level. We can see what people are doing, the revenue it's generating, and then, you know, use that to research that population. That is a very rare case. And it actually is one massive data set that we have that allows us to do that. And then on top of that, we build things like, of course, like Power BI and whatnot. But having the connections at a individual level, it's hard and it is equally valuable. Like there seems to be a correlation between how difficult it is and the value it brings when it comes to the merging these types of data. And then, of course, we're doing things journalistically as well. I think the rule is, we never want to look at anything in isolation, not based on one piece of data. And so where we can be more sophisticated about it, and I've kind of gone in order of most sophisticated to least sophisticated, when it is simply just bringing together two or three or four sources together kind of journalistically, that is far better and far more valuable.
Yeah, when I think about, I love this term, I've never heard it before, journalistically. I mean, there's two parts of it, right? Well, I guess there's three. You think about it, you've got the sourcing, so you've got all the disparate pieces of data, and then it's got to get analyzed. Magic happens there, and then the story has to get told. That's the other part. It's a differentiation than I would put in the normal research camp. Is storytelling a big part of the focus?
Yeah, storytelling. I mean, we're all about influence, and you know, and I don't think you can influence truly without having a point of view told via story. And so, storytelling is huge, and frankly, it's one of the things we're struggling with a little bit as we think about bringing all these sources of data together. Like, it is not enough to throw a dashboard together, or rather, for the most important decisions that we're really trying to be at the table for and influence. You know, throwing a Power BI on the board and having the room look at it is not sufficient.
Yeah, I call that, I think one of the terms I've heard is, and I use a lot, is HI. So it's that human intelligence then applied, right? We're going to see a bigger focus on that in an intentional way over the coming years as technology continues to automate different pieces and then also continues to give us more confusion around, or opportunities is a better way of saying it, you know, to see the consumer, whether it's voice in real time or whatever, right? Those consumer experiences. So what is one of the biggest challenges that internal researchers like you face? And then how do you see, or what do you wish agencies would do in order to help meet that need?
For me, indisputably, it is the combination of multiple data sources and decisions needed to get made at speed. Frankly, trying to get a piece of research done quickly to make a decision in, say, 48 hours is hard. Trying to get a piece of research done quickly and then layer in multiple other sources of data is exponentially harder. We aspire to that. We want to be at the table where real-time decisions get made, and we're able to be strong strategy consultants on those decisions. And so it is just a constant pressure of what's the right data to bring into the table. How do you bring it to the table? What's the story? And then our agencies are frankly, they're such critical partners and extensions of our team. You know, without them, we just simply cannot be successful. And we really rely heavily, heavily on our partners to execute the research, to really get in and understand the business problems with us. Our partnerships to be most successful is when our partners feel as invested in the strategic decision as our FTE team does, and they're in it trying to figure out the right sources of data, bringing ideas to the table, brainstorming. You know, the other thing that I think is really helpful is oftentimes when we're working at speed like that, I find that creativity in how to solve a problem does not always emerge, and I think that that's a problem. So to the extent that our agencies can help us be creative in how we solve or answer questions. I think that's something I'm always looking for in our partners.
To make decisions, it's faster, right? It's faster and faster. And that's one of the neat things that we've all seen in the industry is that, you know, through technology empowered data collection, you know, it's anybody can do a survey now. So the table stakes have really completely changed, leveled up for market research of, you know, being whatever it is that we need to be able to do. And of course, triangulating that consumer point of consumer truth at scale is super hard, and we have to do it faster, right? So that's where I think that pattern recognition at the HI level becomes really important.
You know, it's interesting that anyone can do a survey. I mean, the tools are certainly there. For me, this is where the storytelling and understanding the why and really understanding that whoever your survey population is, they can tell you so much and you need to derive so much from it. You need to connect it to other things to really understand what's driving the thing.
One of the things that we did not talk a lot about in 2017 on the Happy Market Research podcast are sort of the way that the guests processed risk and were willing to take risks. You know, as I did a lot of reflecting and listening to the episodes, I think in 2018, part of the story needs to be risk tolerance, especially in the framework of research. So I would love it if you would tell us about a time in your career where you had to take a specific risk and then sort of how you coped with the anxiety or if you had any at all, you know, around that risk in order to take the chance to overcome it and hopefully has a positive outcome.
Yeah, totally. I think oftentimes in taking a risk, you just have to go in blindly believing that you can figure it out. And if you have that belief, then ultimately something will get figured out. It may not be what you originally intended. I remember very distinctly Chris Kapp, our CMO, saying, "Figure out where we suck." And I had no idea where to start. So the first thing I did was, we said we'd go figure it out. I wasn't going to commit to how or when or whatever. And what it ended up being probably 18 months of really hard analysis, talking, you know, many, many rounds of focus groups and maybe three rounds of serious quantitative work before we figured out not only where we sucked, but why we sucked and what we needed to do about it. And for me, the risk there was not promising I could do it and not promising it in any given time frame, right? It's very easy for us as researchers, certainly, whether or not you're on the client side or the kind of agency side, to say, yep, I'm going to do it in this time frame. And in this case, we, you know, I committed to it, but without a time frame. And 18 months later, we had it, and we had a campaign entirely written around a new audience and launched, which is the AI campaign that you see on air now.
There's a degree of, it sounds like two things. One is honesty/humility, right? And then the other piece of it is successful expectation setting around that.
That might be the most important for any job ever is setting expectations appropriately. But yeah, absolutely. You know, there's other risks too I could point to, but that one was, I felt like my career was on the line. You know, when the CMO says, find out where you suck, and you don't have an immediate answer.
Right. You had to come up with the answer.
Oh yeah. Yes. There was a lot of, you know, pain.
It's not great. It's not great. I immediately start sweating in that scenario.
Also, in retrospect, I was confident we could figure it out, and I'm probably proudest of that particular journey, and in part because it was truly a beginning to end journey. We did not know where we were going at the beginning, and by the end, we had full creative, you know, launched, and just an absolute privilege to be able to be part of that. Many moments of sleepless nights, for sure.
Right. Totally. Sounds like a fun project. Stressfully fun project. So talk to me a little bit about the three characteristics of an all-star employee from, you know, your career view. And you know, I'm interested, it could be like at Microsoft, or if you feel like, you know, you'd rather talk about a different, if there's different characteristics in different contexts, that's fine too. But what do you see as really the three core values or characteristics of somebody who's going to be successful in their career?
So I don't think this is unique to Microsoft, although it certainly applies to our team. I think The first one is an inherent curiosity, just period. I find that folks that aren't just constantly asking questions and trying to figure out why, whether or not that be around a customer or around any other given problem, I think that that is an unteachable quality. Along with that comes some judgment on when to take that curiosity forward and when to stop. That would be the second thing. And then the third thing is a healthy sense of autonomy. Like, I'm going to go figure this thing out. And of course, that has to come with clarity and of clarity of direction. It has to come with some energy behind it from a leadership, etc. But so autonomy to go figure things out. So again, curiosity kind of bounded by a bias for action. And then someone that's willing to take those actions responsibly and appropriately, and maybe even push a little bit beyond that, right? Certainly in an organization like Microsoft, where any large organization where hierarchy is just part of the daily thing, I find that people that are willing to push just a little past what's hierarchically appropriate are far more effective than folks that are like, nope, that's above my pay grade. Having some ability to take those risks and say, yep, that's not above my pay grade. Like, I'm here for a reason and I can do that. Like, those are the people that I think are great. And I find that true every place I've ever worked.
I love that. Curiosity, judgment, autonomy / self-motivation. That's really the engine, I think, that drives a successful outcome for a person's career. You know, you need to operate successfully inside of the hierarchy of the organization, of course. But at the same time, you also need to have a culture of yes among yourselves, right? So that you can kind of bleed into the starts and finishes of specific projects and workflows in order to really understand the output, right, that you're working on generating, for example.
Right, exactly. And sometimes you have to do that not in a culture of yes. You sometimes just have to believe in the thing you're doing. And you cannot always look for that external validation. And hopefully you get it. But I think that pushing forward and in some cases, pushing past the hierarchy, even if you know you're taking a risk in doing so, is often worth the risk. And of course, doing it appropriately and within the bounds of kind of being kind and polite about it.
Yeah, definitely wrapping things up in the context of appropriateness is super important if you're going to get heard. But at the same time, you've got to take those risks. My guest today has been Marian Anderson, Director of Research at Microsoft. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Stay tuned for this episode's CEO Hack by Merrill Dubrow of Mark Research.
You've got to be self-aware, and you've got to be able to allow yourself to have a self-evaluation and trust people around you. So, you know, constantly when you have, I believe I'm never going to be the smartest guy in the room. I believe I've made the most of my skill set. And the reality is I can say, hey, I need to get better at blank. So the interesting thing, you mentioned my blog for 10 years, which I did 3 times a week, and I wrote every one except for a few guest writers. I'm not a great writer. I have good ideas, but I don't have great punctuation or grammar. And I was able to, through this self-aware and self-evaluation, understand that, know that, and surround myself with people who could help me through that. They didn't rewrite the stuff. They just made sure it made sense. So for me, the number one skill is the self-awareness. Give yourself the self-evaluation to know that, hey, I might not be great at finances, or I might not be great at management, or I might not be great at sales, or I may not be great at, you know, something else. And being able to surround yourself with the right people, and also try to get better at something every day.
This point that Merrill brings out is, in my opinion, the most important hack or skill that you can develop as a leader. And that is, be humble enough to recognize that you have blind spots and bolster, surround yourself with people that can help you see those blind spots. I would say if I've had any success in life, it's because of this one principle. So thinking about my relationship with Ervin Andreessen, the first co-founder of Decipher, also Jamie Plunkett and Kristen Luck, you know, all three of those were strategic add-ons to Decipher that helped me as a leader to have a fuller, more complete picture of the marketplace. You know, we each consume and process and retain less than 3% of what actually transpires. That's why having more views of that same environment or that same experience is really helpful, because it helps triangulate what is actually happening, what is truth. I'll also point out that it isn't enough just to have the visibility. You also need to have the will to accept that you don't have the complete view. This is a subtle difference, but it is probably one of the biggest impacts if you can be open to adjusting your point of view based on that external feedback. That quid pro quo can be a fundamental area of strength for you as you build your team, because not only will it help you make the best possible business decisions, it'll also garner trust and respect by your team, which and transparency, which will again sort of self-promote and police this culture of a complete view and a better answer, which creates a better business outcome. Thanks, everybody, for listening to today's episode of the Happy Market Research Podcast. An absolute privilege. We are honored that you would be willing to spend so much time with us. I hope you have a fantastic rest of your day. Please, please, please share this episode on the platform of your choice. If you would just tweet it, or if you would take the time to post it on LinkedIn, it would mean the world to us. This episode is brought to you by Attest. Attest is a powerful, easy-to-use SaaS platform that connects businesses to over 100 million consumers in 80 countries on demand in just a few clicks. Ask your burning questions, select who you want to answer, view actionable insights that help you grow your business. Join the hundreds of leading brands who already utilize the power of Attest's scalable intelligence platform. Contact Attest today at www.askattest.com/happymr. That's askattest.com/happymr, or find the link in the episode's show notes.